Yeah, good afternoon and a warm welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show for Monday, the 29th of April, 2023. I hope you had a fantastic weekend. I hope you did. Thanks for finding me. I've got two terrific guests for you to listen to this afternoon. So if there's anything you'd like to contribute, you know how to do it. Leave a message for me via the app or use richieallen.co.uk. Comment live.
Uncensored, unfiltered. You're listening to Richie Allen on the world's most popular independent news radio show.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Eddie Hobbs is a very respected financial services advisor, wealth management and financial planning and all of that. He's also very well known to Irish television viewers and Irish radio listeners is Eddie. TV programmes for RTE back home, many radio programmes, best-selling books on personal finance and investment. How then did Eddie Hobbs find himself in Cork last week, speaking to a packed auditorium of people about breaking the silence, the WHO pandemic treaty, and discussing the events of the last few years and where they might be heading? We'll ask Eddie Hobbs that very question when he joins the programme a little bit later on this hour. Can't wait to meet Eddie Hobbs. And in hour two then, Professor David Hughes reached out to the programme when I was on holiday. He's a senior lecturer of international relations at the University of Lincoln, and he's an author too, and his latest book is called COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, Volume 1. And it's an open source book, dear listener. You can read it online for free. We'll talk to Professor David Hughes about that in the second hour. So it promises to be an interesting show. Funny thing happened to me there. I was reading something. It happens like once every 6 months and I'd forgotten the time. Just about got on air on time. Getting too comfortable, me. Yep, hope you had a good weekend. I've already said that. Hope you're in good form. And as I said, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what my guests have to say. Do that via the app. Download the app if you haven't before. Use a VPN if they're telling you the app isn't available in your area. I had a great weekend. Went to watch the mighty Salford Red Devils, the mighty, at the Salford Community Stadium on Saturday. Me and Tez, me old mate Tez, Salford defeated the mighty Warrington Wolves in a very close fought game. We met two lovely people. We met Babs and Brent. If you're listening, Babs and Brent, good afternoon. Babs is one of us. She's a Salfordian. Brent, lovely bloke, but he's a Wigan fan. We won't hold that against him. Great afternoon, lovely meeting you both, and thank you for the company if you're both listening. That was a very big deal, by the way. You know, Salford versus Warrington Rugby League isn't exactly Celtic versus Rangers or United versus Liverpool, but it is a big game and it does reach some very unusual places.
Congratulations to Salford Red Devils for beating Wanky Warrington on Saturday.
What did he call Salford? What did he say?
Congratulations to Salford Red Devils for beating Wanky Warrington on Saturday.
Salford? Where the hell is Salford, Donald? And what did he say about Warrington?
Wanky, wanky, wanky Warrington.
Well, fair enough, all right. So Donald was glued to Sky Sports from New York City on Saturday. Yeah, my humour is that of a 9-year-old's. It always has been. Let's leave it there. Humza Yousaf, Scotland's First Minister, resigned. It doesn't matter. Why then am I telling you? Well, because the holders of the offices of state are irrelevant. We surely must know this by now. Soap opera, that is all. He's gone. And a lot of coverage today, understandably, by the mainstream media. The First Minister of Scotland is gone. Apparently he made a big mistake ending the coalition with the Green Party. They were propped up the Scottish National Party, even though they were the main party after the last election in Scotland. But to have a majority in Holyrood, they needed the support of the Greens. They broke that arrangement last week, and apparently he's paying for it today. Like I said, does it matter? Why? Okay, I hear you. Don't mention it. I won't mention it again. Here's a big story. It's not new or news, but it's out there now. and it might save lives, and I don't say that lightly. I talked about this on the Papers podcast this morning, and it is about the admission by AstraZeneca for the first time that its COVID jab can cause side effects. Now, it's sticking to the line that our jab, our vaccine, can cause a side effect, but it's very, 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 very rare, they're saying. Okay? They're being sued, or it is being sued, AstraZeneca is being sued, in a class action over claims its jab, which was developed with the University of Oxford, it caused death and serious injury in dozens of cases. Remember the face of Oxford, or the face of the Oxford vaccine development team? I think her name was Sarah Gilbert. She was given a damehood, Dame Sarah Gilbert. They even made a Barbie doll in her likeness. Do you remember? She's nowhere to be seen lately. Surprise, surprise. Yeah, yeah. Jamie Scott brought the case. First one to bring the case, he was given, he was left with a permanent brain injury, a blood clot, a bleed on the brain after being jabbed with AstraZeneca's nonsense. Yeah, they told his wife three times that her husband was going to die, but thankfully he survived it, although his life is difficult. He developed thrombosis with thrombocytopenia, or TTS. 51 cases lodged in the High Court, victims and relatives looking for damages, which could be worth over 100 million quid. But of course, again, as mentioned earlier on, the UK government has pledged to underwrite AstraZeneca's legal bills. It's got to be one. Unless you know there's something else going on, which you and I do, we think we know what's going on, that would be the stupidest decision ever made by a government in history. Unless you know what's going on. New jabs, you say? Developed in a few weeks, you say? Okay, I'm not going to be a dickhead. Developed in a few months, you say? No real safety data, you say? All right, we'll give them to 57 million people if they'll take them. Or 67 million people. Thankfully, a lot of people said no. Yeah, we'll give them to our people. We'll give them. Yeah, yeah, we won't ask any questions. And don't worry about being sued if you kill anybody, because we'll cover your legal bills. So unless you know what you know, and I know, that's a pretty, well, inexplicable decision. Predictably, and it's a good thing, the many doctors who were silenced by the mainstream media over the last 4 years are calling for an immediate suspension of all COVID shots, and they're right to do so, but they're doing it on Twitter. And it don't matter a damn. Twitter is a prison. Twitter is kettling. Nobody wants to hear this lecture, so I'll keep it brief. If you find yourself on Twitter constantly bitching about technocracy, transhumanism, cashless society, these are good things to bitch about. But they want you on Twitter believing that Elon Musk is the saviour of free speech. He isn't. And you think I'm being harsh on you for spending all of your days on Twitter sloganeering? I'm not being harsh on you. It ain't going to change a damn thing. You've got to get out to people. Like our guest, Eddie Hobbs, did last week. Get out to people and talk to them. Real people, not the echo chambers. Here endeth the lecture for today. Where have you gone? Where have you come back to me? Not the echo chamber dwellers. Anywho. So the broadcaster Esther Ranson, That's Life, and other programmes, is begging MPs to attend a debate in Parliament on assisted dying, which will take place this afternoon, but there won't be any binding vote. This is where, if you get enough people to sign a petition, in this case 200,000 people signed a petition calling for dying people to be able to ask for medical assistance to end their lives. So they had more than 200,000 signatories. Yeah, so the debate will take place this afternoon. No vote, they're just going to debate it. She's dying with lung cancer, and she revealed, didn't she, last year, she had joined Dignitas, which is the assisted dying place in Switzerland. She told the BBC Today an amazing new drug had delayed the spread of the cancer, but that her time was still very limited. She wants a change in the law, meaning that she could look forward in confidence to a death which is pain-free, surrounded by people she loves. Now, not everybody agrees. Here's Amy Prophet, a palliative care doctor, speaking this morning to BBC Radio 4.
One thing we do need to be clear on it is this idea of choice and autonomy. We already know in this country that our freedoms have to be restricted.
What? We already know our freedoms have to be restricted? Why, Amy?
In this country that our freedoms have to be restricted to protect vulnerable, to protect the sick, protect those with dementia. Did we not, during the pandemic, stay at home to protect the vulnerable?
We did, and have you forgotten what happened? Have you developed amnesia, Amy, about what the resulting impact of that crazy decision to tell healthy people not to go outside during a pretty mild outbreak of a respiratory illness? Well,
to protect those with dementia, to protect those with disability. We already know that healthcare freedoms have to be restricted.
She's mad. And of course, the presenter, Michelle Hussein, isn't going to interject. She's not very likely, is she, to say, well, hang on a second, Amy, are we not living with now the after effects of a disastrous decision to lock down not once, not twice, but thrice? But the BBC reporter is not allowed to ask such questions.
And that's for the good of society. So if we are going to legalise this and have a system and have people have the right to have that, it can't be in the NHS. It's deeply dangerous in healthcare. It could be seen as cost-saving for the government even. And I think we need to now explore a conversation in the general public of a different system.
Yeah, I agree with her, you know, on the point of we shouldn't legalise dying. Excuse me, assisted dying, assisted killing. We shouldn't legalise it. I agree with her, but for different reasons.
And not look to physicians-assisted suicide.
So you wouldn't do it if there was a system that where it was akin to a sort of specialism within healthcare. You wouldn't do it as a palliative care doctor.
Absolutely not.
If it was a specialism within healthcare, almost like a, you know, somebody who specialises in orthopaedics or somebody who specialises in ears, noses and throats. So if it was a specialty position helping people die, you wouldn't do it. Obviously not. That'd be... Anyway, let's hear a bit more.
No. In no circumstances.
Absolutely
not even to
not.
Help someone in the kind of position that Wendy Mitchell was in, where they are absolutely in their right mind and there's no issue at all about how they want to end their...
Yeah, she goes on to say, no, I wouldn't do it. I'm of the understanding, through researching this, that nobody who it is known is dying should have, or even does have, an awful death in 2024, because pain medication, pain management is so far advanced now that people don't die awful deaths where they are writhing in agony. If I'm wrong, please reach out to me, drop me a message via the website, via the app. I'll read your comments out as we go along. So you disregard everything she said about staying home to protect the vulnerable. Do you want a few giggles, do you? Sometimes out of the mouths of babes, the truth comes. Caroline Lucas is a former leader and then a former co-leader of the Green Party. She's a Brighton MP, Brighton and Hove. Now she's standing down, Caroline Lucas, after this election. After the forthcoming general election, I should say. And here she was on Times Radio today. It made me laugh. You'll hear the presenter first. Her answer is very interesting. We talk a lot, don't we, about politicians and political parties and governments and about how they are not really in charge of anything and they are merely the deliverers of another agenda. Front men and women, listen to this. You'll hear the, as I said, the presenter.
Give us an example of the dysfunctionality of Parliament as you discovered it.
Well, one of the things that I found most extraordinary was that a lot of MPs, a lot of the time, have no idea what they're voting on. And
what? They have no idea what they're voting on.
Given the opportunity to find out, they're not terribly interested either.
Not interested. So, presumably, the whips keep them updated with smartphone messages. The whips, the party whips. So imagine this baldy gammon, Richie Allen, as an MP. You'd be pinged fairly regularly. Pinged, do you like that? On your smartphone. Richie, get to the division lobbies by 3:25 and you're voting no. What am I voting on? Just get to the fucking division lobbies. all right, you could be voting on anything.
So my reason for saying that is that one of the little campaigns I waged when I first got there was the idea that when you have an amendment to a piece of legislation, it might be quite handy to have an explanatory statement to explain what the purpose of the amendment was, so that when you read in paragraph 3, little c, point 1, change and to or, obviously that means nothing unless you've done quite a bit of research to check out what that means.
Very good. That was actually a good idea by Caroline Lucas, God love her. She said, when there's an amendment to be voted upon, there should be a little explanatory note explaining, you know, kind of a summing up of what the amendment is about and what it means to the original bill. But this doesn't happen. And even though she campaigned for it to be introduced, no, they said. Have a listen to this. This will make you laugh.
And it was just so interesting to see the size of the backlash. You know, the whips were horrified that their own party members might find out what they're voting for.
Isn't this amazing? The whips were horrified that MPs might actually find out what it is they're voting on and the importance of it. And you think you live in a democracy.
And if you look at Hansard now, it is quite remarkable. Seeing
Hansard is the electronic record of everything that is said in Parliament.
All these MPs popping up to argue that they shouldn't know what they're voting for. And yet I had seen with my own eyes, you know, when the bell goes for the vote, you go through the aye lobby, the no lobby. And I've seen MPs, particularly Tory MPs, remonstrating with their whip, saying, I'm not sure if I want to vote this way. And the whip literally pushes them over the sort of the boundary into the voting lobby. And
these are the MPs who actually have read the bill and who do understand what it is they are voting on, remonstrating with the whips, no, I don't want to vote aye, or I don't want to vote no against that. Get in there and do what you're told. Many of them are compromised, we believe, don't we?
And the convention is that once you're in, you can't U-turn and come out again. So that's...
The guy from the Times is laughing along with Caroline Lucas. Instead of saying, listen, cancel the next two interviews on the radio show. Caroline, you're going nowhere, love. I want to explore this even further with you. Is this what's really going on?
It's where you get this ridiculous situation where quite often MPs were hiding in the toilets in order to avoid being counted out at the other end.
So what? MPs hiding? She's not joking. This woman doesn't have a sense of humour. None.
You get this ridiculous situation where quite often MPs were hiding in the toilets in order to avoid being counted out at the other end, so their name wouldn't actually be recorded as having voted the way they did. So after each vote, your listeners might be amused to know people go round the loos making sure there are no MPs still cowering in the toilets, and that is the mother of all parliaments.
That's the mother of all parliaments. That's democracy in action. There's no point in me saying anything further, is there? I'll leave it there. This is the Richie Allen Show. It's just gone 17 minutes past the hour. I've got two wonderfully interesting people for you to meet today. We will be joined by Eddie Hobbs, who's an expert financial advisor, very well known on Irish television and radio. Eddie gave a fascinating, very well put together talk for about an hour and 50 minutes at an auditorium, a hotel, I think, in Cork last week. I want to talk to him about that. And later on in the programme, Professor David Hughes is an author, and he's brave, David. He's one of the few in academia that has stood up against what's gone on in the last 4 years. He's got books, he's got a book we're going to talk about, where he sees this heading, why he believes it's happening, where it's meant to be, where it's meant to go. So it's going to be an interesting old show today. So it is. Let's talk about this momentarily. Smartphones have not been good for children. You know, I know, we know. Jonathan Haidt is an interesting man. He wants them banned for under 16s. He was on the BBC Politics Live programme this afternoon. So he was with Joe Coburn. Now, the presenter, Joe Coburn, asked him, have we failed children?
Yes, absolutely. Across the developed world, we have failed them. Now, we didn't know what we were doing. Between 2010 and 2015 is when everything changed. In 2010, very few kids had a smartphone. They didn't have social media on their smartphone. In 2015, everyone had that in your country, in mine, in the United States. And back then, we were all techno-optimists. We thought, the internet's amazing. Smartphones are amazing. The internet's going to take down all these dictators. So we didn't really mind when our kids stopped doing things in the real world and began spending all their time on screens. But by the end of the 2010s, it was clear across all the English-speaking countries and across most of the developed world, there's been a huge increase in anxiety, depression, self-harm, and suicide. And the self-harm and anxiety has hit the girls hardest. And there's no other explanation, and there's plenty of evidence now linking the phone-based childhood to that epidemic.
Right. What should we do about it?
There's an old vaudeville joke. The guy goes to the doctor and he says, doctor, it hurts when I do this. And he moves his arm in a funny way. And the doctor says, well, stop doing this. Mm. And we basically have taken childhood away from our kids. We put them on screens and we need to stop that. So what I'm proposing in the book is four simple norms that we can do. In my country, I don't expect ever to get help from our Congress. So four norms we can do even without legislative help, although legislation would help. No smartphone before 16, or before the end of secondary school would be the equivalent here in the UK is what you should aim for. No social media before 16. Phone-free schools, the phones need to be locked up during the day. And far more free play, independence, and responsibility in the real world. If we're going to take away most of the screen time from little kids and mid-childhood, we need to give them back a normal human childhood where they're hanging out with each other, outside, playing and learning how to be self-governing.
Let's hear a bit more from him.
Jonathan, do you think the primary responsibility for carrying out those four major changes lies with parents or the state?
Very important question, this. Who's in charge? The kids' parents or the government?
Well, before I can answer that, I have to make clear why we're stuck here is because the tech companies have put us in a collective action problem. So most parents are freaked out by this. They hate what's happening. But any parent who says, no, dear, you're not going to get a smartphone and social media, you're going to be the only one without it, you're going to be isolated and ostracized. That's the situation that parents have been in. That is not their fault. That is not their responsibility. That is a trap that was created by the companies long ago so that by the time kids get to the age of 10 or 11, everyone else is on social media. So the primary responsibility for breaking up the trap, I think, rests with government to force the tech companies to check ages, at least enforce the minimum existing age of 13, which is way too low, but there's no enforcement of that. So we need government help, especially on age verification. But yet, because it's a collective action problem, if we act collectively, we parents can do it without the government. Now, it'll really help to have backup. And British parents are doing it. This is what's so exciting. I'm spending the week in London. Mm-hmm. And you already have parents' movements rising up in arms. Smartphone-free childhood, delay.
Yeah, he says it's happening here. Have you any experience of that or this even? Have you tried to extricate? Have you tried to take a smartphone away from a preteen or a teen? Any experience with it? Messages, your comments, please, to the app, to the website, richieallen.co.uk. The time is now 22 minutes. 22 minutes, it is, past the hour of 4 o'clock.
You're listening to your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk.
Yes, it's on multiple platforms as well. Eddie Hobbs will be on the programme shortly. Thanks for your messages. Thank you. Hi to Mike, Richie. Did you see the clip of Gerald Celente on James Whale? I did. I saw it this afternoon, yes. Gerald Celente is no slouch. He knew exactly who he was dealing with in James Whale and his sidekick. I thought he did well, Gerald. Hi to Bill. Hello, Bill. Maybe Humza will be replaced by a black lesbian midget, as that would tick all the woke PC boxes. Bill, how did you know? The Scottish National Party is scouring its ranks for that very descriptive, that very description, yes. Do we have any black lesbian midgets? Hi to Ian, who says, Richie, can you explain in more detail about the freedom of speech restriction the students in the USA are experiencing just for their support of the innocent in Gaza? Ian, I think it's self-explanatory. Students in several universities, most notably Texas and California, I'm not saying Texas University or California University, but two particular universities have taken up in support of the beleaguered people of Gaza, and in some cases the university is called in the police have come in, people have been dragged away, they've been assaulted. I don't know what else I can say, Ian. It's terrible, but it's hardly surprising what's going on at those universities. Thanks for your message. Hi to Grace Ann, who says AstraZeneca admitted that a tiny minority have suffered from the jab, but they will never admit there is a high number who are and will continue to suffer. I hope nobody will be fooled into receiving any experimental vaccines from here on in, says Grace Ann. Hi to Dario, who claims Elon Musk is a front man for the technocratic universe, the technocratic world to come. One of the 12 apostles of PayPal's mafia, he says. Hi to Johnny and Brent. I watched Eddie Hobbs' video. Brilliant, he says. He explains what's going on very well. Good evening to Tim. Hello, Tim. Richie, he says, LBC presenters were lauding Esther Ranson's stance on voluntary euthanasia, which is not surprising, considering some of their presenters' promotion of the genocide in Gaza. He's referring to one such presenter who does breakfast for LBC, and he's a big lad. God bless him. Going to take music from the Doobie Brothers now. That will take us to Eddie Hobbs. Taking it to the streets, that's kind of appropriate, I think. As a Doobies. Had a great night at the O2 Apollo in Manchester some years ago watching the Doobies. It was brilliant. This is your Richie Allen Show. It's the time 25 past four now, so it is. Yeah, music from the Doobie Brothers taking us to the streets. That's appropriate, as I said. 27 minutes. It is past the hour of 4 o'clock. Live from Salford, it's the Richie Allen Show. Now, my guest runs a successful and respected wealth management and financial planning company. It's HobbsFinancial.ie. Check it out. He's a staple and very well known for appearances on Irish television and radio, national and commercial. And he's written several very successful books, so he has. Now, fascinated I was to learn that he gave a talk at a fairly large auditorium in Cork last week to a packed hall, standing room only. People outside couldn't get in, where he spoke about what's happened in the last 4 years. His impression of it, what he feels about it, where he feels it might be heading, why it's happened in the first place. And I wanted to ask him why. How did he find himself in that situation last week, last Thursday, I believe it was. Let's welcome to the programme Eddie Hobbs. Hello, Eddie. You're very welcome. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm very well. Thank you, Nick.
It's Richie. It's nice to have you on, Eddie. Thanks for coming on.
Sorry. Excuse me, Richie.
Listen,
sorry.
Listen. Stop now. Stop. I imagine you've done 4 or 5 interviews today. Don't worry about it. Come here and I tell you, how did you find yourself there last week? I mean, you're known back home and beyond for your books, for your TV and radio appearances, for your expertise in all matters financial and otherwise. And there you were addressing a big hall of very interested people, hanging on your every word about your feelings about what's happened in the last 4 years and where it's going. How did you get there, Eddie?
Well, I suppose it stems from 2005 when I did Rip Off Republic, which were 4 one-hour stand-up programmes to live audiences. And that drew the largest audience in Irish factual television on the state broadcaster RTE, and it challenged the way Ireland was being run, exposing all of the protectionist areas in it, and drew the ire of the government. And they wanted to bring me before a committee at the time to explain how this was done, because they were horrified by it. And that demand to come before the parliamentary committee quickly disappeared when they discovered that 85% of all the facts came from government agencies. And that the Prime Minister at the time, the Taoiseach, had labelled me a non-factual person. So it was really getting hot. So after that, then the Broadcasting Act changed in Ireland, which meant that you could no longer look down a television camera and give an opinion if you were a presenter. And that more or less brought the end to my career in television. I was only doing it on the side anyway. So I just continued on from then on. I'm very curious about joining the dots around exactly what's happening around what happened around the pandemic. And that brought me into a much bigger story, which I've researched through books like Kennedy's books and, Matthias Desmet on mass formation, and put it all together into the arc of another story, a bit like 2005, except this is called Breaking the Silence. And it's breaking the silence around what's really happening, and especially around the trauma. There's a significant level of trauma still being carried forward, because the mainstream media in Ireland especially have not been prepared to talk about anything to do with the WHO, the World Health Organization, in Bone Treaty, or anything to do with what happened over those years, because they were entirely on the wrong side of it. And that's the reason. The political establishment are the same. And as a consequence of that, the victims of the abuse, because abuse it was, and we now know that from all the data pouring through, haven't had a chance to deal with the trauma, because nobody wants to discuss it. That's changing. I mean, for concurrent with my discussion in Cork City on Thursday evening, you know, the chief oncologist in Japan, Fukushima, was coming forward and basically saying we've got a turbo cancer problem. So it's beginning to break out now, past the resistance barriers, past the fact checkers and all of the monies that flowed to them, past the captive parts of the mainstream media. People are just going to talk about this stuff. And I certainly in Ireland, I can tell you from a political perspective, with the European elections coming up very shortly and local elections and then followed by the general election, there's going to be huge change because people feel that the government in Ireland is reporting upwards.
Eddie,
there's a massive disconnect with the Irish people.
So, Eddie, you see the forthcoming elections not as an opportunity, but maybe you do, but you think those election results will reflect the fact that there is some understanding in Ireland and among Irish people as to that there is something very sinister at play here and that there is a groundswell of understanding. And this will be reflected, you reckon, do you, in the forthcoming results?
I do. I think it's led largely initially by the, people can go down on single issues and not see the multifaceted changes that are going on. And the big single issue, of course, is the immigrant issue, but the asylum seeking problems, you know, that Ireland's capacity to deal with it. People are really concerned about that because the government have not dealt with it and neither have the main opposition party. And that's driven a huge new inflow of new blood coming in to the political system. I've never seen the likes of it as in my time. I'm 61 now, so I've been around a bit. I've never seen anything like what's going on, nor have I felt the energy in the room that was there on Thursday evening. I mean, the emotion in the room was palpable. People were in tears, you know, as I was explaining, you know, what went on, because why they were in tears is that they were beginning to understand that what they felt all along had actually got a framework to it, that it wasn't, they weren't gone nuts, you know, And I think it's also, I think it's because, you know, I spoke to a behavioral psychologist after the meeting to try and process it. And it's the same as processing the first time that you sit down with somebody who's been abused. It's that serious. And except it's collective abuse. And the abuse is because we were told to do this. We were told to set aside, you know, informed consent, that that these jabs wouldn't go beyond the jab site. And now we know from looking at the data on excess deaths and looking at the data on things like myocarditis and clots and turbo cancer and so on, it's just breaking out everywhere. What's happened is absolutely remarkable. But to me, it's only one part of a larger tapestry of change. But what's happened now, I think, Richie, is that the people that are behind this, and we can now, for the first time, they've made the mistake now of revealing themselves. And we can see the moves going on and the interconnections, you know, with the UN IPCC, panic around climate change, and this then around pandemics, the World Health Organization treaty, which is coming in. I've studied. It came in very late, literally a few days before the meeting. So I had to take legal advice on that. But it's quite clear that the whole thing is set up for an assembly line of more pandemic unilateral declarations by the Director General in Geneva, and behind which then the pharmaceutical industry will go from lab to jab in 100 days.
And a transfer...
Nation states...
Yeah, sorry, yep. Eddie, and a transfer and a continued transfer of sovereignty from independent nation states over to these supranational organisations.
Well...
Can I ask on this, Eddie?
You have to be careful there, Richie, that the sovereignty argument is an argument really for barristers. It's much bigger than that. This is an assault. That's what it is. And they're very clever, right? There was a draft of these regulation changes and this pandemic agreement put out over a year ago, and people have been focusing historically, looking out the back window of the car while they were putting together something else. And then when they brought it out, people said, "Oh, we've a victory here," but they don't. It's quite clear that nation states throughout the world are now expected to set up their own pathogen laboratories.
Yeah,
because gain of function hasn't been excluded, it means it's included. And then the PCR tests, which of course were bogus because they were set at cycles, you know, you could set the PCR test at cycles where it could find the bubonic plague in your system, or the Justinian plague. And that this, the same bogus science which is not intended to for this purpose at all, will then be put into the human waste system. Did you know this? Into the wastewater.
I did, yeah.
And then to report then on 24-hour cycles, and that this will be deemed to be a national asset. So, I mean, what's happening here is there's a massive doubling down. The nation states themselves are being encouraged to become much like the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I mean, that's the bottom line on it. And then, there's a review committee set up over Tedros, the director general. He appoints a review committee, and ultimately he still has absolute authority to declare a pandemic health emergency of international concern a fake.
And then take decisions which must be followed by every country in the world. But what about reports that emerged last week that the World Health Organization was pulling away from the pandemic treaty? What did you make of those reports?
Fantastic tactics, because it worked.
Right.
Fantastic tactical, pure tactical genius. These people this has been long planned for a long time, and they set it up this way. They knew bloody well, for example, in the original draft from a year and a half ago, there was this thing about they were going to get member states to clamp down on misinformation and disinformation, that, you know, the definition of which they would decide. In other words, any counter-science, you just clamp down on it. I mean, that was never going to fly because of domestic laws to do with freedom of speech and so on. But it was put in there, and everybody focused on that. Oh, this is terrible. And then that isn't in this one. There's kind of a passing reference to it, because they know they don't need to put it in as a something you have to do and sign a treaty on, because the last time around it wasn't a requirement, yet it was done anyway. You know, I mean, the major platforms were in league with the World Health Organization and the UN, also on climate change, in order to ensure that these things are taken down. Algorithms were cancelling any discussion, any counter-narrative, as you know, on YouTube and other platforms. That none of that was required by treaty. That was just done.
It was done, yeah. Yeah.
So to me, and I was watching the comments coming on in social media, and said they're all following, not all, but most of the commentariat that were kind of resisting this, we're all falling for the trap, falling over, you know. And I think perhaps spending too much time in academia and not understanding that these people are playing they're street fighting here, you know. And they're being very clever about it, and it worked.
There's no real
watering down here. I mean, can I just say this to you, Richie? There's no watering down. At the end of the day, it's lab to jab in 100 days. They're completely crushing informed consent, so that's gone. Which means that, you know, the independent relationship between you and your doctor, which was destroyed anyway over COVID, is now off the table. It's lab to jab in 100 days. And then the World Health Organization is setting itself up as a regulator, because in order to have a jab or any kind of medicine in the area, it has to be certified by the World Health Organization. You know, it's quite extraordinary that this has been done. But I think that, because COVID failed due to the effectiveness of the human immune system, it failed to achieve its objective, if you look at it cynically from the other side, they have to double down now, because they can't retreat. It's a bit like Macbeth, you know, in the Rivers of Blood speech. It has to keep going, can't go back, because it's actually easier to double down, to go forward, than it is to retreat.
And there's a number
of... That's where they are.
Yeah, for years they've been developing mRNA shots for anything you can care to think of. Any ailment, any illness, cancers, and what have you. It's I've been doing shows like this since 2009, right? Interviewing people who 15 years ago were telling me that this was coming. And they were telling me this was coming. They were telling me in detail. Now, they weren't giving me the exact year and the month, Eddie, but they were saying this is what's coming down the line, this level of tyranny. You're listening to Eddie Hobbs. Eddie's an expert financial advisor, broadcaster and author. Gave a terrifically interesting, very, very well timelined and put together speech in Cork last Thursday. Just very quickly, Eddie, were you surprised by the reaction to it in terms of even online? I mean, hundreds of thousands of people have watched it and shared it now, and that's no bloody bad thing, is it?
No, it's not, and we'll have a high quality production of it coming out shortly. What's online on my Twitter account is the sort of the live stream broadcast on it. I think that what actually completely surprised me wasn't just the numbers that turned up; it was the emotion in the room, the common emotion. That I was getting emotional even because it was working on me as well. You know,
yeah.
People really. This runs very, very deep, and it runs very deep not just in a minority of the population. It's the majority of the population. Now, I know a lot of them are still under the spell of the propaganda, but though the large bit in the middle, like 40 to 60%, aren't. They're waking up and they're traumatized. They know that we haven't dealt with this. We've had members of our family died, many of us. We've had injuries. We know of injuries. We know of continuing injuries. And those injuries are not from COVID, quite clearly. They're from they correspond with the release of vaccines. And all you have to do is pick up any text with an open mind about vaccines from any, you know, reasonably credible source, and you'll see the huge problems in going from lab to jab as fast as we did. And then the idea that we're going to continue to do this moving forward and hand over that power to an unelected cabal in Geneva that is funded by the pharmaceutical industry, the very people that will benefit from this, is absolutely remarkable. And then that the political establishment is entirely silent on it.
And if we end up, Eddie, in a place where cash is gone permanently, and again, I've been listening to researchers on this programme going back years, and once cash is gone, and then you have a digital currency, and that'll be a rules-based currency, the rules dictated by whoever, you know, is running or is managing the currency. Do you, as I do, fear that if they get their way, and hopefully they won't, but these medicines in the future, they'll be tied into some sort of social credit system where pressure will be brought to bear on people who, I mean, I said no. I mean, your medical history is your own business, Eddie. I wouldn't dream of asking you. But most people I know personally said no. Of course I'm not going to have a jab that you rushed into existence in a matter of months. Of course not. Don't be ridiculous. In the future, if they have their way, it won't be so easy, will it, to say no?
No, it won't. I mean, if you stand back from, firstly, it took me 3.5 years of reading and engagement with the material, going to conferences, listening to people. And you know, I didn't come to the conclusions I've come to quickly. I'll put it to you like that. I didn't want to face it because it was too big.
Yeah.
In what you're looking at here, and as I said, I didn't come to this quickly, is 21st century totalitarianism. That's what it is, being created in front of us. So when you stand back from the WHO and you look horizontally across all of the changes that are going on, you've got a flood of new people coming into Europe, which, you know, Peter Sutherland, who was a mentor of Klaus Schwab and the WF, was all for. He spoke to the House of Lords in London in 2012 and told them, you can't maintain your one culture. You have to open your borders to everybody. That's what he said. I mean, I covered that in the talk. And then we go through to, you look across the board. There was an attempt very recently to change the very foundation of the Irish Constitution in terms of the definition of marriage.
Yes.
Into enduring relationships. And then you look and you'll see what's going on in terms of the education of children and the gender confusion and sex education, quite graphic stuff at a very young age. That's coming. That all flows out of a UN document. Then you look across the WHO and you'll see this development where they want to get control effectively of land, of animals, humans and plants and ecosystems, that they have the right to declare emergencies across those matters. And then you look at the whole electronic side of it, which is the digital ID. You could stick into the digital ID, then your vaccine passport. You stick into it your currency, your central bank digital currency. When I was writing about that a few years ago, it was regarded as complete nonsense, and it's just around the corner. And you stick that in there, and then you stick in your personal carbon limits. That's it. Game over. You are now a serf. And you have to venerate the center, which is why they want to, you know, that the classic playbook from totalitarianism is to weaken the bonds of family itself, and that's in play. So this is very serious stuff. And will it succeed? It'll only succeed by our permission. It'll only succeed so long as a majority of people in the middle are not prepared to break silence or engage. Or feel that, oh, well, just by throwing tropes at people, that means then that they don't have to engage with the material. That's not going to work now, because more and more people around them are getting sick from the vaccines, and more people are beginning to talk about this stuff openly. You said the cancel culture effect is wearing off.
You said you want warriors, not warriors. I want to talk about this. I want to explore this for a couple of minutes. Eddie Hobbs is our guest. Look, I gave up being devil's advocate on this some years ago because there's no point to it. I used to be very argumentative in these types. I still am argumentative, but in these discussions, there's no point because it's obvious they're creating the digital ID. It's obvious they're creating a cashless society. It's obvious. We've seen what's happened in the last 4 years. So I'm not going to waste our time arguing with Eddie and saying, but the BBC says we're not going to do that. Look, I am very critical of people hanging around on Twitter sloganeering. And the reason I'm critical of them is because I've been doing this job for a long time. Right, independent radio, speaking to everybody about these agendas. And sloganeering on Twitter, while it's great and it's grand, and I'm sure for some people it's comforting, and maybe you meet somebody and it's all well and good. In the long run, Eddie, people are going to have to physically do something about this, right?
They are. I can only talk for here, really, in Ireland, which I'm familiar with. What I find absolutely remarkable is that the people that are organising everything behind the scenes, like the legal people that they're entirely female. The legal people that I rely upon, there's four of them, all women. The people that organised that event in Cork are all women, all women. And other events that will be organised are, again, mostly women actually doing the work. They get organised and they do stuff. Guys talk about it and do nothing. They do nothing about it, as a general rule. That's been my experience. And it makes me to understand something that I know your listeners won't understand, but the whole coming among, that's the organisation of women that were actually behind the events of 100 years ago in Ireland. Right. It was women, again, that got organised. And that's happening all over again. They just said, right, we're doing something about this because they're mothers, or they would be mothers. And there, it's a question of control. It's a question of protecting the family, and that's what's driving them. It's not a breadwinner thing; it's a protection thing. And so that's been my experience, certainly over here. In terms of what you can do, well, the whole idea of the meeting was that it wasn't a talk shop; it was a mustering. It was to do something. So we set up a website. We've all the material up there. That's if people want to research the thing out the wazoo. And there's a whole load of things that people can do, which we gave them to do on the website, as well as starting their own campaign, going after the, we gave them the databases of all the political people so that they can blitz them with emails. They can run campaigns, encourage them to do TikToks and just send it out. We have a symbol, 1215, which of course for those that are listening to your program will know is the year of the Magna Carta. So we've adopted 1215tribes.com as the name of the website. And anybody can use that website. We're creating it so that it can be used anywhere by anybody, can set up their own campaign anywhere they like and put up their own stuff. And the whole idea is to form action groups and help each other out. And then because we're in a febrile political environment at the moment, and I can't speak for Britain, but I do know the Irish political establishment lead from behind, so they'll follow wherever the public go. So we're going to show them where to go, and just let the information out. I think that just getting the information out and talking about it openly should be in a position to tip it over. And we have the benefit in Ireland as well of a ruling from 1987 in the Supreme Court by a wonderful economist and a farmer called Richard Dominic Crotty, who took on the state in 1987 and won a Supreme Court ruling, which said that the Irish government, the cabinet, are the guardians of the Irish Constitution and not the disposers of it, and cannot fetter what has been given to the Irish people in their constitution unfettered. It was a really crystal clear ruling. And of course, that the WHO pandemic agreement and the changes to the regulation in the round are, of course, giving away large parts of the power given to the Irish people through their constitution. Of course they are. But I don't want the whole thing to get bogged down in arguments between two teams of barristers on opposite sides. But to actually just say, well, like, the whole thing is set up for rinse and repeat. But rinse and repeat on a kind of a machine-like basis. That's the plan. And that needs to be resisted with every single with every single way we can do it. And we need to start roaring at the political establishment all over the world, Britain, Ireland, and everywhere else, roaring at them and telling them, you better get this sorted out, or you're going to lose your seat.
I think,
you know,
what,
I'm going around talking to my neighbourhood, my neighbours about this, you know.
And that's what I like, you see. I think speaking to people who swallowed the jabs and who would fall for the RTE far-right bullshit, speaking to those people and reaching them is the only way forward, in my opinion, and not everybody agrees with me. You know, preaching to the converted. And I have a go at myself here because I've been doing this for years. Is a waste of time. We've got to speak to people or attempt to find a way to reach them who have not considered any of this. But as you said so eloquently earlier on, they're feeling it. They're feeling it in their bones. They're sad. They're morose. They're fed up. They're depressed because they have been assaulted psychologically in the last 4 years. It's reaching those people. Eddie, this is an interactive program. We've had literally dozens of comments come in the last 15 to 20 minutes. Here's one from Elizabeth. She's a Dutch lady living in Spain listening to this. Richie, does Eddie think that this summer they might double down with a new crisis, possibly another type of lockdown? She says, maybe even crash the economy, ? In Spain, she says, now I don't know if this is true, but she's telling me, in Spain, the Guardia Civil, the police, of course, they are being offered bonuses if they don't take annual leave this summer. It makes me suspicious, says Elizabeth, because it's never been done before. So what do you reckon, Eddie, to what Elizabeth says there? Crises, different types of crises coming at us. You said it yourself a moment ago. Regular crises, right?
Yeah, well, they're set up anyway to at the back end of the year to look at declaring a global climate emergency. So, I mean, that's an open discussion in the UN. I deal in my talk on what is a remarkable finding by an author called David Webb, who found the smoking gun, which indicates that the entire global financial securities have been collateralized, pledged as collateral against the global derivatives mountain. The derivatives mountain is 2 quadrillion, which is 2,000 trillion. And the total value of assets on the planet is 500 trillion. And the total annual GDP is a fifth of that, 100 trillion. So now you might say, well, perhaps that's his opinion or speculation, but unfortunately, it's not speculation, neither is his opinion. He's found an exchange in March 2006 between the top legal officer of the US Federal Reserve Bank and the top legal officer of a thing called the Legal Certainty Group, set up in the EU to mimic what they'd done in the US, which required them to change, which they did, the Uniform Commercial Code in the United States was changed without any act of Congress from 1994 forward, such that in the event of the collapse of a clearing party, especially a clearing party, that the banks that lent the money into the derivatives mountain would actually have a call on the collateral that had been given, which includes your savings and your investments through your pension schemes and all the rest of it. It's quite extraordinary that your assets, according to this, are being used as collateral to support the derivatives mountain, which is why it has grown. And what's happened here is that this was put before the Senate quite recently in Tennessee, and they got such a shock that within 2 days they dropped all bipartisan tension, and there was a grand slam, 100% unanimous decision to bring out a bill to try and roll back the effect within the state of Tennessee. We were seeing also in the state of Louisiana a straightforward bill declaration that none of the diktats coming out of the World Health Organization or the UN or the World Economic Forum will have any jurisdiction in the state of Louisiana. North Carolina are looking at doing the same thing, and one or two others. So the day after the Tennessee made the decision, I'm told by the author himself, because he gave the testimony to the state senate with his lawyer, David Webb, he told me that the treasurer of the state of Tennessee, the day after they made the decision, was contacted by the banking lobby, and the state was threatened that the banks would pull out of Tennessee if they did this. So there's a gunfight at the OK Corral starting in Tennessee. And there's one thing I know about the American psyche, especially in that part of America, and that's that you don't threaten these people.
No,
you just don't do that. You do that. These are serious people. You don't threaten them. If you think you can threaten these Americans and not get a response, you don't understand who you've just threatened.
And Eddie, if cashless becomes a reality, as seems increasingly likely, bail-ins then become a cinch, don't they? I mean, they become a cinch.
Well, I mean, well, the bail-ins, if, yeah, well, the bail-ins, all of that framework was put together by the FSB, the Financial Stability Board, about 10 years ago when it was set up to avoid having a situation where taxpayers bail out banks. So there's bail-ins. The whole protocol changed for bail-ins. And of course, this was the first time that was used was in 2012. It was tested in Cyprus and it was successful.
It was,
so there was going to be a bail-in across the entire banking system. The parliament was recalled. They sat for 2 days and they said, well, they couldn't bail in the ordinary depositors. So they set the bail-in level at 100 or over 100,000. And they did it that way and took all the money that way, or gave IOUs for the money. That's how they did it. But this time around, if you take it to its extreme, no, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it is possible. And it needs to be said it's possible, even though I'm not saying it's going to happen. And that's that the entire global financial securities could be in play in the event of a collapse of the derivatives mountain.
You're not the first person to say that to me.
Like, one of the things Klaus Schwab has given, he's a bit of an idiot, right? But he's a hand puppet, but he gives away things. And hence his famous expression, you will own nothing, but you will be happy. It makes some sense then, if that were to be the plan. I mean, you could take this to the extreme and say, well, has this been planned? I said, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that because there's no research on that you can go in and prove it or disprove it. Just like the pandemic, was it deliberate or was it accidental from the Wuhan lab? We don't know. We may never know. But what I can tell you is that the global financial system, just as it is at the moment, I don't think that even if they wanted to stop it, no, it could be stopped. That it's planned failure.
What about those, and there are, I mean, some of those who claim that they don't believe there was even a virus. It's not my take on it. I've got to say that. I'm open to all manner of opinions. But I've heard some learned people with qualifications, say that they're not entirely convinced that there was even a virus, that it may have been, you know, seasonal flu or a bad flu season, and that they doctored up the whole, we have a novel coronavirus and it's in play and it's dangerous. When you hear that, does it matter to you? Is it important? Is it relevant? Is it confusing? I don't mean to you, but I mean to everybody. Is it one of those? Well, what do you make of it? Well, no virus theory.
What I find very reliable is that if you look at the work of Robert F. Kennedy, especially in his first book, there was no legal action taken on the substantial level of evidence he has in his book, in his first book. And that's what I like about it. It's not really a normal book. It's an actual prosecution. It builds and builds and builds and builds. And then his second one, which is just out, which is the Wuhan cover-up. I mean, all the information is there. Again, it builds and builds and builds and builds. Over 63 chapters, and it ends in the World Health Organization treaty. That's where it ends. It's all there. And all I did was study it a couple of times and then put a timeline across it to explain who did what and why. And, it looks as if according to the Republican committee that investigated it, they think that the circulation of the virus, there was a virus and it was a novel virus, and it was circulating in September 2019. Whether it was a flu or not a flu, I'm not a medical scientist. I can't say that. But there was a virus and it was a novel virus.
Yeah, I'd lean towards that. That's how I'd feel about it. Again, like yourself, yeah. Not having any medical training at all, that would be my best guess, yeah, and I've read the books you referenced. Eddie, we've only got a few minutes left. Enormous amount of messages have come in during this time we've been speaking. I just want to mention, Eddie's on Twitter, Real Eddie Hobbs on Twitter, and you will find, you'll be able to watch the presentation that Eddie put together and delivered in Cork last Thursday. It really is very good. I recommend you watch it, and I recommend you share it with others. It's been some ride these last 4 years. Glass half full, glass half empty, Eddie. I mean, you're seeing a real groundswell, to use that bloody term again, of a bit of a rising back home in Ireland, where I think even the tropes you mentioned, people being labelled as far right and xenophobic, none of this is working, it's wearing off. You're seeing a real, you know, kind of a standing up against this. Are you optimistic, Eddie, that whatever the plans are for this technocratic dystopian future, where we'll become serfs, as you said earlier on, but that there's enough now of a movement to spark something special is that ultimately we, and by we'll win the day. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I don't think the Irish are any particular special race in that regard, but I do know that I can only talk about my own people, you know, because I'm with them. And I there is a mustering now. I mean, that's quite clear. There is an energy now, and there is an intolerance towards the nonsense. And but the political establishment, and especially the mainstream media commentariat, are completely on the opposite side, in their own bubble. That was demonstrated when they got hammered on the referendums of the 8th of March in connection with the changes to the Irish Constitution. The people came out and hammered them. That's where the Irish do their business. We do our business at the polls. And the polls are coming up again. And I think they're going to get it. I think they're going to get an almighty hammering in the local elections by the Irish people and in the European elections. And it's such that it's going to trigger a general election almost immediately afterwards. And then you're into substantial change, because a lot of the people that will get elected into councils for the first time will quickly move into the national chamber. And they'll be of a completely different mindset. That's the way I see it working out here. I can't speak for other countries. I'm very interested in watching what's going on in Japan, because the Japanese are definitely awake to this at a kind of an academic level, as well as on the street, you know. And certain states in the United States are definitely rallying. The problem with the United States is, you know, as everything goes through the binoculars of the left, the blue and the red, which is tragic for them. But throughout the world, everybody knows somebody who's been hurt by this virus. Sorry, by the vaccine.
Yeah.
And the idea that we're going to hand even greater powers over to this unelected group of people in Geneva, you know, where 1/5 of all their money comes from the Gates Foundation, you'd want to be owning your head when you see the timeline and who's involved to do that, to support that. And those that do support it means that they actually have engaged with none of the material. Because if you engage with the material, it could completely change your perception. If you don't engage, it's very easy to throw tropes at people, because it's the lazy way out.
Really good to meet you, Eddie. I really appreciate you coming on. It was an excellent presentation you gave in Cork last week. Real Eddie Hobbs on Twitter, hobbsfinancial.ie, to find out more about Eddie. Thanks for your time, mate. Look after yourself, and Godspeed to you. Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Eddie Hobbs live on the line from Cork City this Monday. The time is coming up for three minutes past the hour. Your comments next. Don't forget, Professor David Hughes will be live on the programme, and David will be with me in a few minutes' time. You don't want to miss him either. Monday's programme.
Ask not what the BBG can do for you, but what you can do for the BBG. Support the Richie Allen Show now at richieallen.co.uk.
Yeah, a number of you messaged, it's terrible use of language, isn't it, during the conversation. Nelly, for example. Yes, women coming together because we've had enough of the male domination, says Nelly. The return of the feminine, bring it on, it will make for a fair and a just world, says Nelly. Thank you. Hi to Bri. Of course it was planned, says Bri. Event 201 and the 2010 lockstep document have disappeared down everyone's memory hole, seemingly, says Bri. Hi to Edward. Richie, in relation to Eddie's comment on Wuhan, I was shown a page in a novel and it mentions it regarding COVID before the event, says Edward. Thank you, Edward. Hi to Vicky, who says, and she sounds very annoyed by this, on another matter. Humza Yousaf, the outgoing Scottish First Minister, will now receive £52,000 per annum for the rest of his life, half his former salary, as a pension, which will be payable from tomorrow. He doesn't have to wait till he's 68. No scraping by on £225 per week for him. A guaranteed golden handshake as long as he lives, paid for by the UK taxpayer. Should I be angry, asks Vicky, or is it worth it to see the arse of him, to see the back of him? I'd be resigned rather than angry, I suppose, no doubt about it. Richard is in Harrow. I'm with him all the way. My daughter is 11, starting secondary school in September. Richard is referring to an audio clip we heard earlier on from a man talking about banning smartphones for the under-16s. Richard says, my daughter starts secondary school in September. That is when she will be getting her first phone, a dumb one. And definitely no social media for her, says Richard. It's scary how many of her friends already have both the smartphone and the social media account. 6 minutes past the hour. Time for music. When we come back, I'll be introducing my next guest. Busy old programme today. And this is David Bowie, or Bowie. David Bowie and Ziggy Stardust on the Richie Allen Show. It is Monday, the 29th of April, 2024. I can't wait for you to meet my next guest. He is a very interesting man. He's an academic. He is a senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Lincoln. He received, would you believe, his undergrad and his master's degrees from Oxford University. Now, much of his work focuses on psychological warfare and terrorism, and what really might be behind terrorism, and how it might be used to shape people's perceptions, and maybe, I don't know, to convince people that they need to maybe lead a certain life and maybe change the way that people live, right? Really, really interesting this. He's written a number of books, and his latest book is the reason I invited him on the programme to talk today. It's titled COVID-19 Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, Volume 1. Let's welcome to the programme Professor David Hughes. David, it's a real pleasure to meet you. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be on.
No, it's great. It really is. Come here and I tell you, I'm really fascinated by this. Was September the 11th a real... I don't want to dwell too much on it because I want to talk about now and the future. But it seems that September the 11th was a big, I don't know, wake-up call. Is that a fair way of putting it for you? Is that right?
Yes, I'd say so. And in particular, the destruction of Building 7, it's so obvious that there's foul play involved there that was really the snag that started to unravel everything for me. And that's what really got me into this research on psychological operations, because I was just astounded at the fact it could be so obvious, and yet there is still a significant segment of society that doesn't see it.
And where were you at that time, David? Were you in high school? Were you just starting out in university? Where were you exactly?
I had just finished university, and I was just about to start my master's degree.
So you just finished uni, you see this, you think there's something very wrong with Building 7, there obviously was. Was that something you were openly discussing with your peers at the time, your fellow graduates, and if so, were they interested in it?
Well, I have to confess, I was actually asleep for the best part of 15 years. It was only in late 2016 that I actually saw this. So, you know, I don't have any kind of special powers to see straight through these kinds of things. But I think that the thing is, once you have seen it, then you have a intellectual and moral obligation to actually pursue it and try and do something about it. So, yeah, I was late to the party, but I got there in the end.
No, you weren't late to the party at all. I broadcast on the bloody thing, and I thought it was all legitimate for several years as well. So, no. So then beginning to have an understanding of this and writing about it from 2016 onwards, then we get to 2020. Boris Johnson addresses a camera, speaks down the camera lens to the nation and says, we have a virus, we've got a lockdown, you've got to not go to work, you've got to stay home. You knew something was up straight away, didn't you?
Immediately, because of the very hasty passage of the UK Coronavirus Act, which is quite a long document, I think it's about 600 pages or so, which just so happened to be all ready to go and was then rammed through Parliament, a kind of traumatised Parliament, very, very quickly. And I thought, well, I've seen all of this before. It's very similar to the tactics that we used with the USA Patriot Act after 9/11. And again, once you start to understand the tactics, you can draw the parallels and understand that we're not dealing here with what we're being presented with. There's actually more to it going on.
And could you, sorry to dwell on this line of questioning, but again, I'm fascinated because of your status, right? I'm not saying you're better than anybody else, David. You're obviously a really good guy and you're a smart guy, but you have a status. You're an Oxford University graduate, master's. You're a lecturer. Could you then, even in 2020, begin speaking with people? You know, and we'll, I suppose later on we'll come to the future of academia a bit later on in the conversation. But back then, could you have discussions with people along the lines of, I think there's something very wrong with this. Could you do that at the time?
Well, as an academic, I did the appropriate thing and I produced a peer-reviewed journal article in a mainstream academic journal titled 9/11 Truth and the Silence of the IR Discipline. And in that paper, I asked the question, why is it that academia refuses to examine the evidence regarding the events of 9/11? There have been very few exceptions since 2001. And I present a mountain of evidence in the paper, about, I think there's 36 different points of evidence indicating that there's something seriously wrong. And I make some speculations on why it might be that academics do avoid the evidence. And that paper came out at the end of February 2020. And then, of course, 3 weeks later, we were locking down. The interesting thing, just quickly on that paper, is that it really creates an intellectual obligation on the part of academics to respond to it, because if somebody puts forward evidence in a peer-reviewed fashion about events whose political significance can hardly be overstated, that really needs to be addressed. And if it's the case that what I'm arguing is bunk, then that really needs to be rebutted. And fascinatingly, here we are 4 years later and academics haven't touched the paper. They've been reading it in their droves, but no one has actually replied to it.
Could the timing of it have anything to do with this, David, maybe?
I think it goes much deeper than that. I think it has to do with the deep embeddedness of universities and academia as a whole within the prevailing power structures in the world. And there are certain strategic narratives, shall we call them, that I think academics just understand at a deep level they must not question. It's quite sinister.
Yeah, and you're not the first academic to say this to me. So could you extrapolate that and explain what you mean by strategic narratives? Make it as simple as you can for me. Strategic narratives that would be where academics would be inclined to stay away from them to preserve their own futures. What are these narratives?
Well, for example, the narrative around 9/11, that it was, you know, Muslim hijackers, etc. The narrative around, for example, the war in Syria, the kind of the official propaganda that's put out and then is backed up by kind of military grade efforts, also involving the media, which is co-opted, even sometimes involving academics who have been co-opted to then smear anybody who speaks out against narratives, to call for their jobs, etc., to create a very hostile and intimidatory atmosphere in which academics don't feel able to speak truth to power in any genuine or really meaningful sense. So again, fast forward to 2020, then we have all of the COVID claims that were being made. And, you know, it's quite blatant then. You challenge those narratives and you're simply censored or cancelled. So it's a deeply troubling time that we live in when it comes to silencing the truth.
You were hardly surprised in 2020 when, I mean, your former parish, Oxford, we had people like Carl Hennigan, a very mild-mannered and a very listenable gentleman, as far as I can tell, because I've seen him a few times on TV, professor of evidence-based medicine, and he says, you know, maybe we shouldn't do anything at all. You know, maybe the right thing to do is not to do anything and just see how we get on with this and maybe protect the very vulnerable if we can and let people go about their business. And he was, well, to say he was censored is an understatement. And there's no doubt in your mind that other academics would be very cognizant of this. They'd see this going on and it would just reinforce for them, David, that, well, I better shut up. Is that how simple it is?
Yeah, it's a bit more complicated than that. But again, I mean, economic and financial pressures on the university system, going back at least a couple of decades now, have made academic positions, A, very difficult to get, and B, quite precarious. So academics know that they mustn't be too challenging in the research that they're putting forwards. It's also the case that in order to be promoted and get on in academia, you have to win research funding. Increasingly, it's even the case that to get a job in academia in the first place, you already have to have won some funding. So what this means is that almost the entirety of academic knowledge production is being skewed towards following the money. And again, we saw this with COVID at a much broader level, that really when they talk about following the science, very often what it turns out to mean is following the money. So, you know, I went into this profession for noble reasons, pursuit of the truth, love of learning and knowledge and history and so on, wanting to make the world a better place. And what I found has really upset me, actually, because for the issues which matter most, and your previous guest was very eloquent in talking about the damage which has been done in the last 4 years on an unbelievable scale. For those kinds of issues, we need to be able to speak about them honestly and truthfully. And there has been very little academic challenge to any of what's gone on. In fact, quite the opposite has been the case. Academics have tried to make legal justifications for mandatory vaccination. They've come up with algorithms to help Twitter in its silencing alleged misinformation, and on and on it goes. So it's quite an uncomfortable position to be in, to be honest.
You're listening to Professor David Hughes. Now, David is an author, and we're going to talk about his latest book, which he's made open source. And it's entitled COVID-19 Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, Volume 1. Because you've been looking at geopolitics going back decades. And if I mischaracterise anything or misrepresent it, jump straight down my throat, David, and stop me. But it's your contention, I believe, that COVID is as big as it was in terms of a psychological operation, that it is one in a line of manufactured crises in order to manipulate the minds of people to help bring about a very, very bleak future for people, this technocracy. Is that right?
Roughly, yes. I mean, what I argue in the book is that what took place in particularly 2020 and 2021 was the largest and most ferocious psychological warfare operation in human history. And that the purpose of it was to demoralize, disorientate, and debilitate populations across the world, rendering them less able to identify or resist a very, very nefarious set of agendas at work, which in a nutshell involves the controlled demolition of liberal democracy and the establishment of global technocracy, which amounts to scientific dictatorship. So you have a group of people at the top of society who get to scientifically manage everyone and everything. And this idea was first formulated, incidentally, in the 1930s. And when it was originally formulated, it was in the context of the Great Depression and producing a better way of doing economics and society. And the idea was that it would result in increased leisure time for everybody. However, what we are seeing here is an attempt at a novel bio-digital form of totalitarianism, because when you follow through these measures to their logical conclusion, it's truly horrifying what can in fact be achieved through the kinds of technologies that they are now rolling out.
Talk about some of these technologies, if you don't mind. What specifically catches your eye now? We're in April in 2024. I mean, the rate of acceleration in terms of progress blows my mind, but how do you see it? I mean, are there things happening now maybe that people are listening to this might not even be aware of, David, that they can do?
There are, yeah. I mean, your previous guest talked very well about the dangers of central bank digital currency and so on. I mean, that's going to amount to a direct form of control over people's finances. You won't be able to, you know, go certain places, spend your money on certain things, etc. I'm sure your listeners already know about that. The much darker aspect is the kind of work that I explore in Chapter 8 of this book. And by the way, for your listeners, if you just do a search for War for Technocracy, that phrase, put it in inverted commas, The first result will probably be the link to the Springer website where you can download the whole book for free. And what I argue in Chapter 8 of that book, and what I'm also arguing in a series of co-authored pieces on transhumanism, which are currently being published in Propaganda in Focus, is that when you look at the military intelligence literature dating back to at least the year 2000, there is extensive evidence of attempts to produce what they called, over two decades ago, the IT bio nano era. And what that amounts to is an attempt to hook up human bodies to a wireless external control network using nanotechnologies. Now, again, it sounds like the stuff of sci-fi, and in certain ways it is, but there is such extensive evidence for this. And when you look back to some of those documents from the turn of the millennium, they're actually pitching the years 2020, 2025, and 2030 as the time when this kind of thing will be rolled out. So it's really quite eerie that the COVID nonsense began in 2020. And they even talk in those early documents about serious psy war. That's their phrase, serious psy war. In other words, serious psychological warfare to accompany the rollout of this kind of technology. So I think what we're looking at here is potentially a clandestine and very dangerous form of technology which can go under the skin, to quote Yuval Noah Harari, and potentially operate within human bodies and potentially connect to external networks. As I say, you really need to read the material in Chapter 8. It's quite extensive on this, as well as my other work on transhumanism. I appreciate that it sounds wild when you first come across it, but there is a mountain of evidence to support this. And I think people need to be a lot more open-minded that as we move into this era where these injectables are being relentlessly promoted, we need to be open to the possibility that this might be about much more than just something that is pharmaceutical, and that we might be dealing here with military technologies potentially, whose purpose can only be nefarious.
This is of great interest to me, of course it is. And look, one of the ways the commercial and national media like to denigrate and put down and ridicule those of us who are interested in these areas, and I don't have your expertise, I mean, you're doing it properly, I'm just a reporter. But one of the ways they do it is, Bill Gates and the nanobots and the vaccines, and they laugh at people. And this is a constant thing I've been hearing for the last 3 to 4 years. But I know, because I've seen DARPA news reports, I've seen DARPA documents, I've been listening to people going back years talking about Regina Duggan and all of these people, that they've long planned to be able to introduce nanotechnology to people through injectables and otherwise. And you think it's feasible, David, that this might be happening at the moment. And how would this happen now? Would this happen through the COVID jabs? And if so, I've got to ask, how could they get away with that without somebody blowing the whistle on it and saying, you know, there might be more than just mRNA technology in these jabs. There might be something else going on.
Right, there's quite a few points in there.
Yeah.
I mean, firstly, in terms of what you're saying about the kind of denigration of those who ask questions, it is quite easy when academics are asleep at the wheel and not doing the research on this,
yeah,
to say, well, where is any serious thinking on this? And all you have are, I don't know, blogs or, you know, people tweeting about stuff, and it can all be made to seem a bit amateurish and a bit far-fetched, etc. So I see my role as almost unique in the world as being somebody who can see through a lot of the propaganda and the psychological operations, but who also has the skill to approach it in a diligent, rigorous academic fashion to actually try and lend some academic weight to some of these claims. And that's what I've attempted to do in this book. So, I mean, when we look back at the injection campaign of 2021, which, of course, was touted from the very beginning when Bill Gates in April 2020 was saying, you know, we need to vaccinate more or less the entire world. You know, why do we need to do that? Why is it so important to get these things into as many people as possible, all the way down to children? I actually published an article before the vaccine, well, injectable rollout in this country reached the 5 to 11 age range, titled COVID-19 Vaccines for Children, A Tale of Establishment Corruption. And I argued then, at the start of 2022, that there was no sound scientific or moral rationale for continuing to roll out these injections to ever younger ages. And by the end of 2021, really, the whole rationale for continuing to push this, despite the known risks and dangers and harms, was very clear. So we know here that we're dealing with a very dark agenda. Why on earth would they need to be trying to get whatever it is that is in these vials into as many people as possible? A reported 5.55 billion people. So another paper I produced was called What is in the So-Called COVID-19 Vaccines, Evidence of a Global Crime Against Humanity. That's 130 pages long, that paper, and it looks at the evidence from 16 different research teams from across the world, microscopists and spectroscopists, who have actually taken the time to look for themselves at primary evidence. They've put the contents of the vials and indeed the blood of vaccinated patients under the microscope, and they've reported their findings. And I summarise all of those findings in the paper, and they converge around some quite horrifying commonalities, that there are all kinds of undisclosed elements in the shots, including very unusual kind of geometric shaped structures that shouldn't be there, elements that seem to respond to EMF radiation, peculiar ribbon-like structures, and so on. So if you're actually serious and you look at the primary evidence, you can see that we're not being told the truth about what is in these things. You have to ask, therefore, what their true purpose really is. And as far as I can see, it can only be nefarious and possibly eugenics-based.
I think you're incredibly brave. I'm not in any way now mollycoddling or patronising you in any way. You're very brave because you know yourself how fantastical it sounds. You've even said it yourself. But that shouldn't prevent you or anybody else from exposing it, if, in fact, it is what is really going on. And as you said, you've put the papers out there. The names are there. The researchers who've had a look at these vials and had a look at the blood of the people who consented to give their blood so that you could try and determine exactly what was in the vaccines, and these unusual structures and shapes that, you know, you wouldn't expect to be present in the blood of somebody who might have had a vaccine for something else. It is horrifying stuff, David. I mean, it's horrifying. It's cutting edge, and it can't be an easy place for a guy like you to be, I don't imagine.
It's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And again, I tease out some of the implications of where this could all go and what it could all mean in terms of a highly advanced military technology being rolled out on the population. Because if it is possible, if it is, and there is evidence that it may well be possible to connect human bodies to an external network in this way, then you can monitor and track everybody right down to the level of what their organs are up to. You can link them up to a financial system, the infamous 666 patent from Microsoft in April 2020, which talked about rewarding people with cryptocurrency if they were making the correct kind of body movements and so on. But it gets much worse than that, because in principle, this could be used for remote identification of targets for assassination. All kinds of questions have been asked about the potential connection to 5G. There's a lot of questions there. I don't have any answers, but what I do know is that 5G hasn't passed any adequate safety tests. You know, the possibilities are so frightening and so terrifying, and yet the majority of the population laughs it off as so much nonsense. It's a very hard place to be.
I want to just mention the book again, and you can remind us the search term people need to put in. It's COVID-19 Psychological Operations and The War for Technocracy, Volume 1. You are listening to Dr. David Hughes, Professor David Hughes. David is a senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Lincoln. He received his undergraduate and master's degrees from Oxford Uni, and he has other doctorates and qualifications as well. He sounds pretty rational and pretty reasonable to me, and I'm not here to endorse him, but he's saying some absolutely terrifying things. That maybe the jab rollout of 2020, 2021 and beyond 2021 was in fact an excuse to deliver a nanobot or a nanotechnology system into the bloodstreams of as many people as possible in order to grant a third party, whoever's behind it, unique control over everybody who is injected with the technology. A previously unimagined level of control, right down to David, as David said, you know, complete control over your individual organs in your body and maybe even control over what you think. It sounds like sci-fi, but I'm interested in it. And it's important we're talking about it because David is not, as an idiotic LBC radio presenter often says, he's not Doris on Facebook. You know, he's an academic, a credible academic, who's published many papers and many books. People will say, it sounds very James Bond, this. So who, David? Who is it? Who? I mean, I'll ask this question to my listeners and I'll get a variety of answers. You know, there are the listeners who blame the Jews. It's the Jews, it's the Jews, we blame the Jews for everything. It'll be Klaus Schwab, it'll be Bill Gates. Is it a consortium of individuals? Because to me, they're faceless and nameless. Who's trying to do this to humanity, as far as you know?
Right, well, at this point, I would advertise another book that I've got coming out on June the 4th called Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State. And in that book, I argue that the attempt to fashion a global form of biodigital totalitarianism in many ways is modelled on what the Nazis did during the 1930s. And in that book, I explore the class relations behind all of this, because fundamentally, totalitarianism is the most ruthless and brutal and perhaps efficient way of subordinating the working classes. So back in the 1930s, Wall Street was fully behind totalitarian regimes. It helped to fund them. There was even the attempted business plot in the United States in 1933, which was an attempt to turn the United States fascist. The whole world could have fell at that point, were it not for the intervention of General Smedley Butler to foil that plot. So we know that this is the nature of the people at the top of the capitalist system. We're dealing fundamentally with finance capital here. Of course, the major players a century ago were, you know, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers, and Fords and so on. We know who all the big names are. I include them in the book. And what I do in that book is I trace the fact that the Nazis weren't really defeated in 1945. Many were rehabilitated and taken over to the USA and other Western countries, that their skills, expertise and methods and so on were covertly used by the CIA. And you can trace those methods all the way through the Cold War, in terms of kind of mass murder of civilians and torture and all kinds of other brutal, gruesome methods. And you can actually trace them all the way through to the present via Operation Gladio and false flag terrorism and keeping populations in fear in order to be able to exploit their minds through propaganda and so on. You can trace it right the way through. So when we arrive at the present and we see so many similarities, as I describe in Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State, between what has taken place since 2020 and what took place in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, it's very clear to me that this is about a global class war in which the ruling classes of all countries are now uniting and combining in an attempt to suppress and keep in check a population of 8 billion people many of whom are growing increasingly restive as a result of however many years we've had of austerity. And that ruling class position is now in jeopardy as the old systems of control, the old paradigms of control come apart, and they have to find a new way of maintaining control. And global biodigital technocracy is the form of totalitarianism that they're aiming at. If they succeed, the results could be irreversible. Humanity could be plunged into a new dark age from which there is no re-emergence. This is what we're looking at. The possibilities of these technologies and this kind of control far exceeds anything that Hitler or Stalin could have imagined. The situation is so grave and so serious that this is why I've chosen to devote my efforts to exposing it and publishing books and papers like this, even if it may ultimately cost me my career.
And it probably, I feel really bad saying this, it's not very professional of me maybe, but it probably will, won't it? Because we've seen it before. I don't know of an academic who's gone as far as you have, or who has been as courageous in saying, look, even though this sounds bonkers, it might very well be happening. And it's certainly worth exploring because, you know, we've seen it, as you said, going back before the 30s, but from the 30s onwards. It's likely, isn't it, that you'll get a knock on the door or a phone call or an email at some stage. So in that...
Well, it's already happening.
It's happening now, is it? Yeah.
It's already happening. So one in three UK universities currently is making redundancies. That's 50 plus universities. That includes my university, which is making 200 redundancies. That's about 10% of all staff. And last week, just 6 days after my... book came out, I received notice that my job was at risk. So I now have until Wednesday next week to decide whether or not I want to apply for voluntary redundancy. Compulsory redundancies will be finalised by the 10th of June. And this is how it goes. So even though technically the two things are not related, I'm now in a vulnerable position. And, you know, we know how hierarchies and management respond to these kinds of conversations and genuine challenges to power. So I am imagining that this could well mark the end and of my academic career, for no good reason, I might add. And if it does, then I would like to appeal to your listeners that if anybody has any other employment opportunities for someone like me, then please do get in touch. And I'd also like to encourage people really to support my work. I'm really going to need the support going forwards, I think.
Yeah,
so,
I was going to give it a big plug because, yeah. I mean, you put the current book out open source, and I'm going to put a link on the podcast notes to where people can download it. But you've got a Buy Me a Coffee page. Now, you might have more than that, but feel free now to plug that, because I say to our listeners, if you do download David's latest book, and he's got a new one coming out, and thankfully WH Smith is listing it, that's good, at least for the time
at
being
at the moment.
Yeah, for the time being, yeah. But COVID-19 Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy Volume 1, you can download that for free, and it's well worth it. But if you do, I recommend you send a few bob to David. Is it Buy Me a Coffee? Well, give us the link, I'm going to put it on the notes anyway.
Right, okay. So, yeah, I did set up a Buy Me a Coffee. They haven't finished approving the account yet, which is a little bit worrying, but hopefully they will do in the next few days. But you may just want to just hang fire a few days if so. It's buymeacoffee.com/DA Hughes. One of the points to make about this book is that I managed to achieve the impossible in some ways by attracting £14,000 of funding to make this book open access and freely available to anyone to download. So legally, you can download this book for free, and you can share and redistribute it for free because it is licensed under a Creative Commons license. The flip side of that is that I don't make any money at all, not a penny from this book. I don't receive any royalties, any fees, nothing. So at the moment, I think there have been something like 12,000 downloads of it, and seven people have bought me a coffee. Now, this is volume one. You know, if you, the public, want to see volume two, you know, it's kind of half written. If you want to see it completed, I'm going to need serious funding because I have a young family to support, including a son with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. I won't be able to carry on doing this work going forwards unless I get that support. So buymeacoffee.com/DA Hughes. If you want to download the book, search War for Technocracy as one phrase. That tends to bring it up straight away. I also have an academia.edu site, which is ulincoln, all one word, ulincoln.academia.edu /David Hughes /papers. It might be worth having a look there if you're interested in supporting me, because I give a few other means of support, which are not just buy me a coffee. So that might be worth taking a look at as well. I'd also just like to plug the fact that I will be launching a new website, hopefully within the coming days, and the website will be omniwar.org, omniwar.org. It's not live yet, but it will be soon.
Well done. You've got a lot on your plate, haven't you?
A hell of a lot.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. But congratulations on this book and your book, which is coming out on July 4th. Do me a favour, on or before July 4th, come back on the programme. And we'll talk about your forthcoming book, and we'll plug the bejesus out of it. Yeah, these are dark, awful times, aren't they? They really are. How do you cope with it personally? I mean, knowing that this is going on, that there is a movement against humanity like this, almost unprecedented. How does that sit with you? Because it isn't easy to cope with it. A lot of the time.
It's not easy at all. What this kind of work does is it takes you into spiritual or religious domains, because we're dealing here with questions of ultimate meaning and significance. And if you are not able to stand up against this and oppose this, even if there are very significant risks, such as the one that I'm now going through, then what do you really stand for? You know, what real meaning is there? Because this is coming for us all, as totalitarianism does. It's coming for us all, and it's coming fast. And the implications don't bear thinking about. So there's no time, really, to be dithering. All of us have to do something, whatever it may be. I remember in the early days, I'd listen to podcasters or people like yourself, Richie, you know, offering some kind of resistance and trying to speak the truth. And I thought, oh God, what can I do? You know, I'm not a journalist. I'm not a radio presenter. I'm not a podcaster. I don't have those skills. I'm just a mere academic. Well, it may have taken me time to do this. I mean, writing that book was 3 years of hard intellectual and emotional labor. But I got it out there in the end. You know, I'm doing my part in whatever way I can. And all of us need to do that now. There really is no time to waste. And you asked your previous guest about kind of, you know, prospects, you know,
yeah,
optimism, pessimism, etc. I'd say that things are much more finely balanced than the powers that be would like us to believe. They use the propaganda to try and encourage us to think that we're all fringe. They use all of the shadow banning and the censorship on social media and so on to herd people into silos and make them think that they're not reaching anyone. Of course, the freedom of reach, not speech, or speech, not reach, or whichever way around it is, you know, this dreadful thing that they're doing. However, when you look at some of the cold facts, so, for example, by July 2022, which is when most of the injection rollout had occurred in the UK, even according to UK SHA, Health Security Agency, data from July 2022, 23% of all adults in the UK had refused to take a shot. Now, we know that the statistics for anything COVID-related have been massaged and abused very significantly. So that 23%, that would be a minimum figure. It's likely to be higher than that. So even though you may not know or necessarily see people speaking out, I think there's an awful lot of people that know something is wrong. You know, we could be talking a third of the population, maybe more here. And therefore, we should take comfort from that and keep pushing, because we only need to win over, you know, a certain segment further of the population. And then the balance of forces tips in our favour. So we just have to keep going, and we don't have any choice but to keep going. The stakes is far too high now to remain inactive.
Yeah, and I probably should have asked about the spiritual aspect of all of this, because a lot of my listeners will believe that there is something more going on here, you know, some ancient battle for humanity, for souls. And it comes up from time to time in the programme, and I'm fascinated by it. We might get into that in a future programme. But all that's left for me to say today, because I do want to read a few comments, because you won't be surprised to hear, of course, that a lot of comments have come in during our conversation. But you've been listening to Professor David Hughes. Now, look for War for Technocracy online, and you'll find a download link for the book COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, Volume 1. So do download it. But please go to buymeacoffee.com/DA Hughes. And if you do download the book, or if you haven't downloaded the book, you've been listening to this today, do support David. You've got to support now independent journalism and independent academics and authors, because they're being shadow banned and banned and kicked out of universities and colleges up and down the country. It's the only way to do your bit, really, to make sure that the free flow of information endures. So do that. COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. It's sobering listening to you, David, but it's important. And there's a lot of humility emanating from you. So I really appreciate that too. I'll give you the final word, as I always do. Thanks for coming on. And when your next book is released on or around July, it'll be July 4th, but on or around that date, do come back on and we'll pick it up again. Final word to you. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Richard. Yeah, the publication date for the next book, at least the Kindle edition, I think, is actually June the 4th rather than July the 4th. The hard copy will be available in this country in July. But please do keep an eye on that, because the two books work together. The War for Technocracy book, the middle six chapters are all about the psychological operations that were deployed against the public, involving techniques of shock and stress and trauma-based mind control, the use of fear and threat, cognitive attack, deception, mass paranoia and hysteria, and so on. A lot went on, which was all about assaulting the population, essentially, and cowing it into submission so that these very dark agendas can be advanced. If you want the bigger picture in terms of the global class relations involved and the similarities with Nazi Germany, then the next book is the place to look for that. It's called Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State. A shorter version of that book has been available since July 2022 on Propaganda in Focus, the same title, Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State. That's about 15,000 words. The book is much longer. It's a greatly expanded version of the article and makes some much more significant points in some ways. So that's what I've got coming out. As I say, there's also a four-part series on transhumanism with two co-authors, Lisa Johnson and Dan Brody, appearing at the moment, one a week in Propaganda in Focus. So I'd be very grateful if you find anything of value in my work. Please do try and support me, because I'm really going to need it going forwards now. My life is currently in the process of being turned upside down. So thank you, Richie, for the opportunity to come on.
It's been an honour. Thank you, David. Godspeed to you. All the best. Professor David Hughes, live on Monday's Richie Allen radio show. The links mentioned will be on the podcast notes. The podcast will be online around about 6:30 or thereabouts. Thanks so much to David. Lot of commentary there from you. Wonderful, courageous guys. Jan, thank you, Jan. Appreciate that. Hi to Mary Doyle, who's in Kildare, who says, that warrants listening to again, Richie, on the podcast. She says, thanks for your work. I generally don't do anything, and that's not modesty or false modesty. It's the guests, the people putting in the hard yards, doing the research. Look, I'm not here to endorse anything. I don't know if there is or if there was nanotechnology in the jabs. I don't know this. I really don't. But when people who have graduated from Ivy League universities and who are currently lecturing and working as senior lecturers at prestigious universities, I want to know why they're saying these things, and we should listen to them. We should listen to them and make our own minds up. You know, he didn't sound barking to me, did he, David? And again, it's not for me to editorialise or to tell you how to feel about what he said, but he didn't sound stark raving mad to me, to be honest. And I'd like to know what was in those jabs. You know, these mRNA shots that they released. I'm sick of saying it because I'm boring myself. At the speed of light, they released these things and then brought enormous pressure to bear on the population to take them for a disease that they had downgraded in mid-2020. Earlier, they had downgraded it from a high consequence infectious disease. They downgraded it and said this isn't that serious. Chris Whitty, the UK's medical officer, chief medical officer, I should say England's chief medical officer. That, I'm not going to swear, that guy went on national television in May of 2020 and delivered that famous speech where he said effectively that COVID really wasn't that serious at all. He kept diluting it and diluting it and diluting it. Remember that very famous speech he gave? I'm sure I don't have the link to hand. I do have the link where he says most people who get it won't even feel that they've got it. A small group of people will become ill. An even smaller group of people again might need to be in bed for a few days. An even smaller group of people again might need to be sent to hospital for a few days. And then he went on to say, but most of those people won't even become seriously ill. I mean, it was gaslighting in the extreme. This was like 2-3 months into a lockdown. This guy was going on telly saying it's not the end of the world, COVID. Don't worry about it. And the question that David Hughes is asking, which I'm really interested in, knowing that COVID, whatever it was, wherever it came from, was an unthreatening virus for most people. Why the desperation to get so many people, or to try to get so many people, to accept the jab? Why? That's the question. Was there something else going on? Was there something in the jab? Were they conditioning people physiologically through the jabs for some future technocracy, as David believes? So I'm fascinated by this stuff. And I know that whenever anybody talks about vaccines on, and it's a very rare thing that a listener will be allowed to phone into a national radio station and question vaccine injuries. But on the rare occasion when they manage to get past the, you know, the pit bulls in the offices of these radio stations, the receptionists, when they do get on air and they say, you know, I'm hearing a lot about these jabs hurting people, the presenter immediately goes to, you're one of those who believe that the vaccines were filled up with nanobots by Bill Gates. It's interesting, isn't it, how they always go there. Thank you so much to Professor David Hughes, a really interesting guy. I look forward to speaking with him again. And thanks to Eddie Hobbs, the financial advisor, broadcaster and author who came on in the first hour. I enjoyed listening to Eddie also. That's it for the programme. We'll speak again tomorrow at 4 o'clock UK time. Before that, though, tomorrow morning, pretty early, there will be a papers podcast. You know that by now anyway. From the BBG this Monday, it is Sloan Tommel. Bye now. You can dance if you